Hello and welcome to the Dietitian Mindset Podcast. I am your host, Jesse McGinley, a registered dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition. The intention of this podcast is to cultivate more conversation and awareness around the field of nutrition and dietetics to elevate the profession as a whole. Conversations will not only be surrounded around the progression of dietetics, but also the mindset shift that occurs with behavior change, how to evolve as a professional within the sports world, how to collaborate amongst an interdisciplinary team, and approaches, perspectives, and research from others in the field. I hope as listeners, you leave each conversation inspired and open to a new perspective. And with that being said, enjoy today's episode. What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode. Today's guest, I am so excited to share this conversation with you all because it brings so much insight, so much perspective, so much knowledge on the topic of discussion. So today's guest is Sam Moore, a female sports scientist, PhD candidate, and former strength coach. She shares her journey of from being a college athlete to pursuing a career in sports science and strength coaching to now being a renowned female physiology researcher in the field. And so we talk about kind of all of what goes into that and also just the emphasis on the self-awareness piece and the self-efficacy piece of being a female in sport, whether you're an athlete or work in it or working adjacent to it, it's just so crucial. And then we discuss her research and knowledge on the menstrual cycle and how that impacts training. And then likewise with her research on creatine and the effect on menstrual cycles in general, just because that topic is not talked about enough and it is emerging in research. So I'm excited to share and excited to highlight Sam and all the work she's doing and her perspective. It's a fun conversation and I hope you all get something out of this. Every resource that we talked about, all of Sam's publications can be found on her website, More Sport Science with two R's and more. So that is M-O-O-R-E sportscience.com. And on her website, you can find all of her publications, all of her podcast episodes that she's been on, and then any way to connect with her. So again, hope you all enjoy this one. If you do enjoy this one, just make sure you're sharing it, make sure you're saving it, make sure you're giving a review, good or bad. I love reviews. And yeah, I will see you on the other side. All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Dietitian Mindset Podcast. I have an amazing guest on today's episode, a female sports scientist, a PhD candidate at University of North Carolina, and former strength coach Sam Moore. So Sam, welcome. Welcome to the Dietitian Mindset Podcast.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for working with my calendar because we did talk about this a long time ago. It has been a long time in the making and you've been so kind.
No, I get it. Yeah, I completely get it. Working in sports, I also...
Yeah, you were busy.
You
were busy.
Table
March
it.
And April. You were busy.
Exactly. Peak basketball season. But anyways... Yeah. Sam, please, your background is amazing and extensive, and I just want to highlight how great of addition you have been to, like, female athletes and sport and science and all that, but please kind of outline your background of, like, how you got here and all of your experiences leading up to this point.
Yeah, it's definitely been a journey. I would say it's an atypical experience. I'm originally from the Oregon coast. I grew up with two All-American athletes for parents and an older brother. So I played every sport that we could in our small little remote coastal town. I went to college and I played two sports in college, volleyball and track and field. My freshman year, I had a season-ending knee injury, halfway through my freshman year. And it was as devastating as they are for any athlete that goes through it. I think it's all too common. I didn't tear my ACL, so a little bit of a misconception. But everything beyond my ACL was pretty blown out. And it really, like, it ignited my love for the body, for physiology, for, like, through the whole rehabilitation process. I had strength coaches at University of Portland and at Western Oregon that absolutely, I mean, almost single-handedly gave me my career back. And so when I went into college originally, I was an English major for a year and a half. And when I went through my surgery and my rehab process, I switched to exercise science, and I wanted to find an applied program, which is one of the reasons I ended up transferring from University of Portland to Western Oregon, because I wanted to be a strength coach. And I wanted to give back to my athletes what my coach gave to me, you know, if I could just give even like a fraction of that, in the way that, you know, like when you play sports, for me at least, the volleyball court was my sanctuary. Like that's where I was 100% confident. I knew why I was there. I felt like the powers that be put me on earth to play volleyball. Every fiber of my being was built for it. And then for 9 months, it's taken away from you. And like the one place that you want to go when everything else is hard, that's the place that you can't go. And then I ended up having to medically retire. I had to get a second knee surgery after my senior year. And that was really difficult. I had to kind of walk away from sports for a while to make the transition from being a player to being a coach. And so in that, I traveled around and I was a traveling barista for a while, which is always like just so funny to people. I had like an offer for a full-time strength and conditioning job at a D1 school, or this offer to be a traveling barista for Dutch Bros. And I was like, I think I'm going to do Dutch Bros. I felt like I needed a little more personal development. Like the concept of empathy was not one that I knew about, and I needed to learn that. And I needed to learn about like the human condition and other people. And so I traveled around with Dutch Bros for a few years and loved it. And then I wanted to get back into sports. I just didn't quite know how. Like kind of the other side of my brain was like a little hungry for some interaction. And so I started my master's degree at Cal U. It was a remote program. It was like a accelerated program. So it was a 2-year master's in one. And I finished that with a lot of certifications, which is like one of the reasons I went into it for strength coaching. And so during that time, I moved back to the Oregon coast so that I could focus on getting my master's. And then I got a substitute teaching license to be able to pay rent, but like kind of choose when I work to have that flexibility. And so I did that. I taught high school Spanish, which is always a funny joke because I don't speak Spanish. So, you know, I had my time as Senorita Moore. I taught middle school health and PE. I was a head track coach for the high school. I coached college volleyball for a semester. And then I was every day in my little cinder block office in the girls' locker room at this 712 school. I couldn't get Netflix and I couldn't get social media. The Wi-Fi didn't let you get on those websites, and I didn't have any service in the cinder blocks. And so I would do two things. I would scroll job boards for any job in sport, and I would, for like a year and a half, this is what I did every day during my prep period and during lunch. So I would scroll job boards and I would read research papers. So I had heard a podcast with Dr. Stacey Sims, and she was talking about like the menstrual cycle as like a roadmap. And I was like, what is that? That like, it had never dawned on me. All my time as a college athlete, mm-hmm. it had never occurred to me. And so I just started going onto Google Scholar and looking up papers and just reading every single day at lunch. And that was ultimately how I taught myself about female physiology, because even in my master's and in my undergrad, you get like one lecture about the menstrual cycle, and you really get it from the intent of the menstrual cycle, which is reproduction. And I wanted to know about the impact of it, which is literally everything else. And so I found this internship at University of Utah in sports science. And I was excited because I had like a contract role back at University of Portland as a strength coach, and I really enjoyed it. And I loved those staff. But my brain works like once I solved the problem, I wanted to move on from it. Like I felt like when I was being a strength coach, I was kind of solving like a similar set of problems with every team or every, you know, like every season. And so I didn't know what sports science was. I had never heard of it before. I didn't have all the required qualifications when I applied at Utah, but I had people call in and like call in personal favors just to give me an interview, which is a really common theme in my life. And like, I would always, because I was applying for jobs like left and right. I was applying for strength coaching jobs, for volleyball coaching jobs, for like instructor roles at universities with my master's. And I couldn't get a call back and I couldn't get an interview. And I've always said, like, I was like, pretty average on paper, a little maybe below average apparently. But like, I was like, if I can just get in the room, like if I can just get in front of them, right. I can wordsmith them. I can talk them into anything, you know? And so I got an interview with Ernie Reimer when he was at Utah. And in the interview, he was like, hey, you know, this is also like one of my go-to stories. But he's like, I just want someone that can do like some basic coding, like really simple algorithms. I said, I have no idea what that means. You keep saying R. I don't know if it's a letter or a word. I know people are really mad about the Instagram algorithm lately. That's where I've heard the word algorithm before. And I know that I could HTML code an incredible MySpace when I was 14 years old. And that's all I have to give you. I've done one project in Excel. I had to do a budget for like a class project. So I have none of the skills that you are saying that you want.
None of the
skills. But no, not one of them. I said, but I am a really hard worker. One time I was a high school Spanish teacher and I didn't speak Spanish. I'm a really good teammate and I like to have fun. I like to have a good time. And anyone that you call will tell you those three things, that I'm a hard worker, I'm a good teammate, and I like to have a good time. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can offer you. And he was like, okay, you're hired. And I was like, okay, great. That's phenomenal. So I picked up my whole life and I moved to Utah for an unpaid internship. And I was lucky that because I was a teacher, I had a paid summer. And so you get paid for 12 mm-hmm. and work for 9. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I've got a whole pay. He was like, it's unpaid. I'm like, totally fine. I've got 3 months of income to survive on. We'll figure out the 3 months when we get there. But also I said, can you tell me what sports science actually means? And can you tell me what I'll be doing every day? And he said, you'll figure it out when you get here. And I was like, okay. And so like my parents, I think I was 24. My parents were like, no, that's great. You've got student loans from your master's. You have a job that you're leaving with health insurance, with like a really nice cushy salary as a head coach. And you're going to go move to Utah for a job that you don't know what it means. You don't know the industry you're working in, and for no money. And I was like, yeah, this is a phenomenal plan. And I don't understand why you guys aren't on board. Okay. You guys should be so proud of me that I got this internship. So I picked up and I moved to Utah. And it was, I mean, like when I look back, like there are a couple like defining moments, you know, and like that was one of them. Like in my professional career, like, you know, the first one is probably like my knee injury. Totally changed the trajectory of my life in a positive way. This job at Utah totally changed my life in a positive way. And so I went to Utah and I just like learned, and it was one of the best experiences I've ever had. Like I just look back on it with such fond memories, the staff that I got to work with, the strength and conditioning staff, my sports science staff, which was me, one other intern, Paul Mentley, and Ernie. And it was just like the three of us, and we were just like cruising around. And then after like a week, I had a meeting with the head volleyball coach, because part of like the internship that Ernie wanted me to fill was to help volleyball kind of transition to this new system. And I knew the associate head coach, Emily Shoji, who's at UNLV now. But so she was like, you know, you're going to meet with Beth. And I was like, oh my God, like Beth, I'm here. Like she's such a big deal in the volleyball world. And she's like so prolific, like I'm so nervous. And so I like went in there and I had a meeting with her. And then she offered me the opportunity to be volleyball sports scientist. And so she actually like rearranged the budget. She found money for me in the volleyball budget to pay me just to work with volleyball. So then I got to be a volleyball scientist. And I mean, like credit to her, she didn't know me. And I was, again, like I was 24 years old. I was so young, and she brought me on travel trips, and she took me to the NCAA tournament, and she fed me and clothed me and paid for a roof over my head. I mean, and like the things that she would like, the fault, like we'd be in these staff meetings and she would be like, well, Sam, what do you think? And I'd be like, what do I think? I don't think anything. I just got here and I don't know what I'm doing. You have been coaching for longer than I have been alive. We should stop asking me what I think, you know, like, but she did. And she gave me an opportunity to be a part of it, you know?
I think that's so pivotal in a early on in your career, like to have somebody be like, what do you think? Or like, what are your thoughts? Like the confidence and the empowerment that comes from that
even if you're like, I don't have any fucking idea what I think in this moment.
Like, yes. No, what? I mean, like, it's so true. Like, it gave me a confidence in myself that I absolutely wouldn't have had. And I think part of it too, like, I think it is also to Ernie's credit in that, like, he had worked with that program for 3 or 4, maybe 5 years before I got there. And so he had already built in this trust that essentially, you know, Beth kind of thought like, if Ernie's choosing her to bring her in, then he must trust her. And I trust Ernie, so therefore I trust her. And I will never remember, like, I turned 25 when I, like, in preseason, and she came, she was like, hey, I heard it's your birthday. And I was like, yeah. She's like, how old are you? And I was like, you know, 25. And she patted me on the shoulder and she goes, yeah, I was 25 when I got the head coaching job here. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I mean, it was just like, you just, like, every day you're in the presence of greatness, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, like, also growing up in the volleyball world with a mom who played volleyball, which meant, like, I was raised around my mom's teammates and they won 2 national titles together. And so I just, like, that was something like that felt like super, like, I knew that, like, very familiar to me. And I just felt so lucky and grateful every day to go into this environment that was, like, just high performance, just elite, in every sense of the word. And so some of the stuff that we got to do there was so cool. It was incredible. And, so then, you know, like, but the whole purpose of the internship was also to get a job. And so we had to do, like, these mock interviews, and Ernie would be like, you have to apply for a job. And I was like, Ernie, I just, none of these really fit my vibe. I'm just like, I just feel like these aren't really my vibe. And he's like, well, what is your vibe? And I'm like, I don't know. But when I look at the jobs that I see, I don't vibe with any of them. Like, I'm not getting the right vibes. And he was like, you can't make a career out of vibes. You know, like, you've got to get a job. I'm like, okay, that's fair. And so,
like, but I'm comfortable here. I know these people. People like me. Like, I can figure it out.
That's what I said. I'm like, these are good vibes here. And he was like, yes. And you're also on a contract and that ends in December and you need a job. And I'm like, yeah, you know, like you are right. Like, I can only defer my student loans for so long. Like, that's a good point. Like, I'm like, yeah, but also, like, I could sell my car and just, like, ride my bike. And I would, like, get money enough to, like, live for, like, another 3 months if I sold my car.
We can make it work. Ernie, we can make it work, man.
I'm saying, like, I've thought about it. Okay. I'm not planning.
That's amazing.
So then he was like, okay, you know, like, basically he was like, what do you want to do? Do you want to coach college volleyball? Do you want to be a sports scientist? Do you want to be a strength coach? Do you want to coach college prep? He was like, you're qualified to do all these different things. And I think that's something too, that, like, if I look at, like, kind of a big rock of my career, like, I have been told that my interests are, like, too broad for so long, but I never, or, like, I couldn't not be interested in all those things. And so I didn't, because I didn't totally know what sports science was, I didn't understand, like, the generality of it. And so I was like, you know, we're going through it and I'm like, okay, I think I want a hybrid role. And he was like, shocker, surprise, surprise. You can't decide. He was way nicer about it though. I was like, I think I want a hybrid role, because in my first week too, he said, you know, if you could answer any question, what would it be? And I was like, I think we should train our athletes differently based on their menstrual cycles. Like, I think that across the menstrual cycle, we should be training differently in terms of, like, the capacity for adaptation to training.
Yeah.
And I think that that also differs based on different birth controls. And he was like, okay, that is a really interesting question. Keep that in your back pocket. And so I was like, okay. And speaking of that, I've actually already designed a whole training protocol for different types of hormonal landscapes from my little cinder block experience in the girls' locker room, because that was all I could do.
I have a whole binder of notes. So
yeah, I was like, I've actually been doing this in my spare time for years now. So whenever you're ready to go, you just give me the green light. And so I was like, I want a hybrid role where I want to be a sports scientist because I want to solve different problems related to women, really. But I want to be a strength coach so that I can implement this training and evaluate it. But I can't have too many teams because I haven't worked out all the kinks of this kind of training protocol, some of these interventions yet. And he was like, okay, so you want to write your own job description? And I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. And so then I think it was like in the fall, that fall. So I had been there for like 3 months. The NC State job came open and it was originally advertised as a director role. And it was a hybrid sports science strength and conditioning role, but because it was a director, I was like, I've been a sports scientist for a total of 3 months as an intern. I mean, like, sports science is here. It's quite young in America, but I can guarantee there are people with more experience than 3 months of an internship in sports science applying for this job. And so I didn't apply for it at first. And then I got a call from Ernie and he was like, this seems like a really good fit. This seems like what you've been looking for. I think you should apply. And I was like, oh, I don't really have the qualifications for it. And then I got a call from Kat Wade, who was my coach at Portland, and Brad Scott, who was my coach at Portland. And they were like, we think you should apply. And I was like, okay, fine, you guys, fine, I'll apply. And they had said, Kat and Brad and I think Ernie, they all knew Nate Brookerson, who was the director at NC State. And they were like, we think you'd work really well with Nate. And I was like, well, I have heard horror stories about how scary that man is. I was like, I'm a little terrified from what I've heard, but I'll apply. And so I sent in my application. And sports science is also it's kind of a smaller community, because it is so new. And I think strength and conditioning, any discipline that you're in, everybody knows everybody, you know? And so I was hearing that all these other people were getting second and third round interviews, and I hadn't heard back at all. And so I was like, okay, I probably didn't get the job. And so Ernie was like, well, I'll call and then just have Kat and Brad call. And so it's the same thing. I had people call in personal favors to get me an interview, and they were like, listen, I know on paper, it might seem average, but just give her a chance. Guilt trips and you know, I'll name my firstborn child after you, Nate Brookerson. Just please give her an interview. She's got to get a job. And so he did. He did. He gave me an interview. I'm not sure if I told this before, but he gave me an interview, and I also didn't know this until later, but he had thrown out my application. He was like, she's way too young. Mm-hmm. She's 25 years old. This is a director role. And that is fair. And so he gave me an interview. So we're on this FaceTime interview, and he said, what's your dream job? And this, I know I've talked about before. And I said, it's not this one. And he was like, okay, what is it? And I was like, well, I don't want to be a soccer gal. I don't just want to run GPS technology for soccer. And this is a men's and women's soccer role. I said, I want two women's teams and I want to train them based on their own physiology. And so here's what that would look like. And so in the application process, there are also multiple, it was a six round process. There was the initial application, and then there was a question packet that you had to do and a FaceTime interview and then another question packet. And then I had two more FaceTime Zoom interviews passed in. And so in one of my question packets, I had explained this is how we would train across the menstrual cycle. And this is how it would be different for different birth controls or menstrual dysfunction. And this is kind of the physiological rationale of why we would change training and how do you do it in a team setting and all those different things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to Nate's credit, he went to the moon to get me the funding to do it. And he came back 6 weeks later and he offered me that job. Wow. And so I took it. And I also remember there was, you know, one point where they were like, you know, you really need to come out to campus for an on-campus interview. And I was like, we're in the NCAA tournament.
I'll see you when I get there.
Yeah. I don't have a day that I can take off. We're at BYU this weekend and then hopefully we're at Stanford next weekend. And so I took the job over the phone and then I, as soon as we, you know, finished in the tournament, I came back and I packed up my life into my little Jeep and tiny U-Haul and I moved across the United States to work for Nate Brookerson. And again, that was one of the best decisions I'd ever made. And so then, you know, fast forward, that was in 2019. I worked for 2 years at NC State. It was an incredible experience. The staff that I got to work with, I got to be so experimental, so innovative. I had support from all the support staff around me, my athletic trainers, the sport coaches I worked with, they were incredible. Nate let me be wild and crazy. And he was like, as long as you have a why behind what you're doing, that's what matters. He was like, strength and conditioning is truly experimental. It is all trial and error. And so you just need to make sure that you have these processes in place so that you know if it's working. And that's any strength coach, right? strength and conditioning is, it is experimental by nature. And I think researchers want to think that strength coaches follow the research, but in reality, researchers follow the strength coach. And so that was such a cool time. I loved my teams. But I got an email one day from a faculty member at UNC, from Abby Smith Ryan, and she was talking about, they were doing like this multi-site study with like some physiological tracking in female athletes. And she was like, it sounds like, from what I've heard, that this could be something that, that aligns really closely with what you're doing. And I was in a remote PhD program at the time. And she's like, I don't know what you're doing for your dissertation, but you know, like maybe some of these data you could use or whatever. And I was like, well, I think I'm actually going to withdraw from that because I'm having some difficulties with, you know, the program, and it's not really what I was hoping, and I'm paying for it. And she's like, well, I don't know you, but you know, like there's funding out there that's available. And so that turned into like kind of a 4 or 5 month conversation. And I ended up leaving NC State to go to UNC Chapel Hill to get my PhD with her. And that's where I've been ever since. So.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. To be honest, like
it's a wild ride,
the whole thing. But I think it shows, I mean, I tell my students and younger, like aspiring, like people just starting out, like the people, you know, like get like the people that will fight for you in rooms that you're not in, like get those people behind you. Like, yeah. And those people are going to mentor you. They're going to open the doors for you if you need them to, like, yeah. Or at least, like you said, like get in front of people, like, and you also weren't afraid of it. Like you weren't probably afraid to like pick up the phone and be like, yo, this is what it is. Like, I am just passionate about this. It's not like, and at the time, like for listeners that don't know the context behind like the physiology and the menstrual cycle and the research and the training adaptations, like, were there people doing that at that time? Like, were there like a ton of people doing that or no?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it was right before, or it must've been during when Dawn Scott was with the US national team and she was doing cycle tracking. So they were tracking menstrual patterns and symptomology, and then also doing some like targeted, like individualized interventions. Like they had different like nutrition protocols, behavioral protocols for people, for athletes that would have like different amounts of symptomology. Because what we see is like from a performance context, there's not differences in performance outcomes across the menstrual cycle. Like you can get up and you can go and do your job any day in the menstrual cycle and you can set a world record at any point.
Right.
The place that performance kind of comes into question is really with symptoms. So every individual can have really wide variances in like the severity of their symptoms and the frequency and the types of symptoms that they experience, and symptoms can really impact the experience. And so that's kind of what the US national team put on display and really publicized, and it was the first time that people had really talked about it at like a high elite sport level. Stacey Sims had a book about it, kind of a little bit more focused with like the book was like more general population. But she had also worked with like individual, like endurance athletes in terms of like some tweaking training. And so at the collegiate level, like I didn't know of anyone that had done it. And, it was also difficult. Like you face, like, you know, people say like, there's just questions you can't ask. Like you can't ask athletes about their periods. And I was like, every other piece of data we collect is private health information. This should be treated as the same thing. Mm-hmm. And like, it is a biomarker of health. And so, you know, like when I was at Utah, like I had to present to like the strength and conditioning director and the, you know, all the volleyball staff and the SWA and like different ADs and the dietitian staff, like there's a lot of hoops to try and get it going for sure. And I think that's also why when I got to NC State, I was lucky in that the two sports I got were volleyball and soccer. Soccer is incredibly progressive just as a sport.
Right.
And there was actually like, there was not a head coach for the volleyball team when I arrived on campus. And so really I was like, okay, so that takes two people I have to convince out of it. Nate's already on board. So really it was down to like my dietitian and my athletic trainers. And I got so lucky. Like the dietitians that I was working with, they were so great at that time. Both of them left like a couple months after, and I was so sad because they were awesome. They were like, yeah, I can see this. Like, this totally makes sense. And it makes sense that like we might have to, you know, like do some different nutrition interventions, either based on symptomology or based on like just general recovery, things like that. Like, they were like, yeah, I can, this science like makes sense. My athletic trainers were like, I think this is great. Cause I was like, really, like, I'd want it. Cause it's like, when we're thinking about not performance, but like a training, from a training scope, it's about like matching the amount of training load to the physiological landscape and what kind of adaptations are available to us. And so there's research about like altering the frequency of training sessions, of like resistance training, doing like more frequent resistance training in the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle compared to the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. But in a college landscape, like, you can't say, okay, you started your period, so you're going to be coming in every other day this week, and then you are ovulating, so you're just like one day next week. Like, you just like can't do that. Like, they have hours and they have classes and practice, and like also the weight room is like a team environment. Like, we're building culture in there. Like, really, like, big picture wise, the weight room is the place for like you to come in, you to go through difficult things with your teammates, and you to like come out the other side. You know, like, that's one of the things that I think that the weight room is for. And so you can't change the outcome, like, you can't change the frequency that athletes are coming into the weight room. But my thought was like, I can't change the frequency, but I can change the training variables. And so I can change what the training session looks like. And so if we're looking at this, like, if it's gas in a tank, right? There are some days from like across your menstrual cycle where you come in with just inherently less gas in your tank. And so if I'm giving an athlete that has a quarter tank and an athlete that has three quarters of a tank the same training program, and it's a quarter of a tank, when they get to practice, now this athlete has no gas in their tank. And actually the load that I'm putting on them is more detrimental than this athlete who can take that and is in a place where they can adapt to it and get the benefits of it. And so that was kind of my rationale. And I was like, I think that, you know, like, athletic training also plays into that, particularly in the recovery. Like, there should be days when, like, if we're going to load up, if the athlete's in a place where they have more gas in their tank, then let's choose when we're going to load up kind of their BFR days in the athletic training room compared to like just their feel good days. Like, we should be considering that in the global load of the athlete. And so the athletic trainers that I worked with, they were incredible. They were super on board. And the athletes were too. And the buy-in was not difficult. So, you know, like, it definitely, and there's a lot of things that you have to think about that, like, we should be thinking about with any data that we're tracking on athletes, like data security and data privacy and data ownership. But when you bring menstrual cycle into the mix, people are a lot more concerned. And I'm like, I totally get it. Like, and I had, like, I would go meet with like IT services, like in athletics, and then with the university, and like, are we a Microsoft school? Are we a Google school? If I'm collecting PHI from a Google form and storing it on our university cloud, is that protected? Is that like a safe place to store this information of like subjective wellness and reported fatigue and, you know, like mental fatigue and the sources of their mental fatigue? Like, so making sure that all of those data privacy and security elements were in place. Like, that's something that I think there's a lot of coaches that have reached out to me about doing some menstrual cycle tracking. And I think it can be really beneficial, but also being really transparent with the athlete about like, what's this going to be used for? What are the specific decisions that are going to be made from it? Like, if, you know, if you're on your period and your fatigue is here and your sleep is here and blah, 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 what does that look like in your training program? And what does that look like in your nutrition or your rehab that day? And so I was just really upfront about what data I was going to be tracking, who was going to have access to it, who was going to be able to see it, and then what decisions were going to be made from it. And I think that's really critical to involve the athlete in that decision-making. Because also the other big part of it is like, yes, staff and practitioners need to be educated about it, but so does the athlete, because they're only going to be a college athlete for 4 or 5 years, and then they're gone, and they're going to have a menstrual cycle for potentially 40 years of their life. So, you know, preparing them for their physiology and what's next, like, they're a stakeholder in that process, and they should be involved as such.
Yeah. And I think it speaks worlds on like the education to the athlete too, like the buy-in and like, why are we doing the things that we're doing? And then what does that look like? And like, knowing the why behind all of that.
Yeah.
Sometimes, a lot of times being a college athlete or an athlete in general, you're just kind of like, cool, you want me to do this in the warm up? Perfect. Like,
yeah,
no questions asked, or like just so minuscule of an example. But like, it, when you talk about data, or when you talk about data collection or data points, and there's just so much more, even if we go down the road of like body composition data, the GPS mm-hmm. tracking, the load tracking, like there's so many more markers, I guess.
Yeah.
Evolving. Yeah. And especially on the topic of menstrual cycles, when it is so untouched.
Yeah.
Like for women, like it is really like, you don't know, like it's not talked about outside of like the fertility or outside of the reproduction, like in the yeah. health classes or as you're growing up, like there just hasn't been too much research on it. But I do want to circle back to when you mentioned training and the analogy of having gas in the tank. So that's kind of a common analogy in like nutrition too, obviously, with like gas in the tank. But like, can you like briefly go into like what that means, or what cycle, like what type of, like when the gas is full in a cycle, or what does that look like? What is the gas?
Yeah. So I think a lot of it can also be measured like subjectively in terms of like how you feel. Like for a lot of women, because we're not really taught about the full extent of the impact of the menstrual cycle, we're just taught about the intent of it. There's like this fragility, and it still persists today in like academic literature. There's a perceived fragility around menstruation, like your actual period. Like when my mom started her period, they made her like go lay down in a dark room, you know, like they're really worried about it.
What is that show? It's like The Handmaid's Tale. Like,
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And like, and even like the perceived fragility around like the uterus itself, like mm-hmm. that's why like women weren't allowed to triple jump or pole vault in the Olympics until the 90s, you know, because they thought like, and like, if you look at like the literature, like it said like uterine injury, like they thought that our uteruses were just going to like fall out on the track. You know, and like now we know that they're not, and how cool for us. And wow. So, yeah, like, and I think also, like, when we talk about menstrual cycle symptoms, people always think about, like I face it today. We'll bring in women, you know, like perimenopausal women for a research study. And like, I'll be like, okay, how long is your menstrual cycle? And they'll be like, 4 days. And I'm like, right. So that is a period. And that it makes sense that you might think that, but the menstrual cycle is actually from one period to the next. It's like the whole, it's a cycle, it's big. And so like you'll have like doctors that'll say like, when was your last cycle? And I'm like, okay, like the definition of the word is cycle. That means like it never ends and it never begins. It's always happening. From menarche to menopause, baby, I am cycling for 40 years, you know? and I just think like there's even like this basic terminology that like we're just not totally dialed yeah. in on. And whenever you're actively bleeding out of your body, you're going to be hyper aware. So when I ask you retroactively about like, what are the menstrual cycle symptoms that you experienced, you're going to think about like your cramps on your period, or the fatigue with your period, or like really you're going to focus on that time when you're actively bleeding. And that makes sense. Like it's like logistically that makes sense. But when we look at like the density of symptoms, that premenstrual window actually is a time when a lot of women experience more symptoms if you're tracking on like a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And so in research, like sometimes we'll get the feedback that like asking subjects to do like daily questionnaires is like a higher participant burden if you're not going to analyze it on like a daily level. However, the only way to capture the full landscape of the menstrual cycle is to do it daily. So I know, like for me, example, my period is great. My luteal phase, which is like that second half, like those 2 weeks before I start my period, it's so rough. And like we make jokes about it in our lab. Like I'll like see a little video of squirrels and I'll be like, get a little teary. And I'm like, it's like this luteal phase, you know, and there's like a 4 day window. And like, I just feel like I'm a walking zombie. Like, and until I started tracking it every day, like I didn't realize like how badly I felt in my luteal phase. Like I would have these like existential spirals. I'm like, I'm 28. I've got nothing to show for myself. I've accomplished nothing. What am I doing here? North Carolina, I'm a whole world away from my family on the West Coast, you know. And then you like start your period 4 days later and you're like, oh, okay. So that's I'm tight. Actually okay.
Yeah. So to speak on that for a minute, like,
yeah,
that existential crisis, or even just like the body dysmorphia, like some women are like, oh my God, like I look totally like this today, or like what is going on, or just like kind of just like those, what is happening like on a physiological level to kind of like explain that? And I know that's like, Jesse, what are you asking me? But like, what is happening? Like,
yeah,
like the hormones, like the jokes around the hormones, like that's a thing. But like,
yeah,
what is actually happening on a physiological
level? Honestly, it's such a good question, because like if we look at the menstrual cycle, which is like day one of your period until the day before your next period, that's one whole cycle. So the first day of your period, your hormones, and when I say hormones, I mean like your female sex hormones. So estrogen and progesterone, a little bit of like luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone. But estrogen and progesterone, like those are your heavy hitters. They are at their lowest point across the entire cycle. And so it's always funny when people are like, you have an emotional reaction and they're like, oh, you must be on your period, you're so hormonal. And I'm like, not that being like completely impossible. Okay.
Actually, yeah. I feel better that.
Yeah. Actually, my hormones are like as low as they're ever going to be. So that's crazy. So they're like, they're low, right? Estrogen starts to rise in like preparation for ovulation, and progesterone stays quite low. And so that first part, the whole time from your period to ovulation, that's your follicular phase. And what's interesting about the follicular phase is if you have changes in the total length of your cycle, which is totally normal, you can have fluctuations of cycle length like up to 9 days and there's nothing wrong, right? Mm-hmm. It's normal. It's normal variation. Those changes in length, they happen in the follicular phase. So there's not like a set amount of days. So if you've got one woman who has like a 30-day cycle and one woman who has a 24-day cycle, the difference in those two cycle lengths are in that follicular phase. And it's that building into ovulation. And so once ovulation occurs, I kind of think about it as like dominoes. Like you kick that first domino and it's like a time course. And so if you've ovulated, most commonly that luteal phase, which is the first day of ovulation until the day before your next period, that's about 15 days, 14 to 15. And it is like a pretty steady time course because it's got these feedback loops. So, you know, like if you've naturally cycling, eumenorrheic, you've ovulated, it's a pretty standard window of time. And so those changes are really in that follicular phase. And so once you've ovulated, estrogen is really high, progesterone is low, whoop, the egg is released, right? With the ovaries, and then it goes to fallopian tubes, right? So we've ovulated, then estrogen declines and progesterone starts to rise. And estrogen also does come to like a second peak in the luteal phase. So that midpoint of the luteal phase is when progesterone and estrogen are at their highest. Mm-hmm. And then that progesterone is produced by the ovum, like the shell of the ovum. And then once it sees that, like, it hasn't been fertilized, it hasn't been implanted, then both of them start to decline. And so for me, during that decline, that's when I get the like emotional effect. Mm-hmm. What am I doing?
Yeah.
What am I doing with my life? Where am I going? Like, my husband will make a joke and I'm like, how could you say that? And he's like, this is crazy because last week you laughed at it. You thought it was so funny. Like,
ooh. What is happening? Yeah.
Yeah. He was like, this always hits. And I don't know why it's like not going well, but I'm like, okay, I'm sorry, you know? And so, and then once, like, I always know when I'm going to start my period because I sleep so well the night before. And for me, my sleep is the thing that's impacted the most. So I don't sleep as well during my luteal phase. When we have high progesterone, it makes it difficult to, we don't thermoregulate as well because both progesterone and estrogen make that cellular barrier more permeable. So it pulls water out of the cell into the extracellular space. And so we can think about that as like not as well hydrated, right? And so we run a little hotter. It's more difficult to get into REM sleep. So you might sleep for 9 hours and you just don't feel as rested. That's what happens with me in my luteal phase. And it's quite common for a lot of women. And then that premenstrual window, the about 5 days before your next period, that can be a time of really heavy symptomology. And so you're not going to know that until you track on a daily basis. But you know, it's like, it's also a big joke in our lab that like, once I start my period, I'm like, oh, finally, you guys, like, I'm back. If, you know, like, if anyone needs me, I'm available now. I know I've been unavailable, but I'm back. I'm feeling good. You know, like, I sleep really well. And then I'm like, my HRV is like so high. My resting heart rate drops like 5 beats. And I'm like, today's the day. Today's the day.
She is back.
She's back. I've been waiting 26 days to get here. It's so happy to be back. Thank you for your respect and your patience during my time away. You know, and so, but like also with that, it is like I feel so great on my period because my luteal phase is really bad. And so like, that's something that like, we are taught that we feel bad on our period. We're taught that we feel weak. We are taught that that's where our symptoms are. And it makes sense of why we're taught that. And like, we internalize that. But once you start tracking, that might actually be a window when you feel really great. And you wouldn't know that. Like, I had an athlete once and I was like, are you like, we're going to set a training max today. Like, that's what we have on our schedule. And she was like, oh, but I just started my period. And I was like, no, perfect.
That's great.
Yes. Yeah, no, like, that's the day. Like, Paula Radcliffe set the world record for the marathon on her period with cramps. Like, we can do that. This is great. And she was like, oh my gosh, like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah. And she went in and she blew her max away by like 15 pounds. So it is one of those things where like, some people do also, though, have really severe symptoms on their periods. And so it can be highly individual. So when we're thinking about gas in the tank, it's not just what phase are you in? It is also, how are you sleeping? How is your mood? What's your nutrition like? How does your body feel? And I think when we're tracking that, another thing is like, when we think about tracking menstrual cycle symptoms, we think about tracking negative ones, but we've also got to track positive ones. So I like the four quadrants. I like positive and negative, physical and mental, because I also want to be able to articulate to my athletes, when do you feel great? Like, if you want to get some extra work in, this would be a time, a really great window to get that extra work in, because you're sleeping well, you're feeling good, you're fueling well. This is a good window for you to get a little extra work in, and you can handle it because you've got a little more gas in the tank.
Right. And I think all of that's like so on par. And I think we joked before we hit record about self-awareness, and like, a lot of people just don't have the awareness with the cycle.
Yeah.
Like, if you are interested in this, like, if you're listening, like, hop on and track your cycle and track like the, oh, am I feeling like this because I'm in my luteal phase and like, I'm crying at things and like, having these emotional things is just for that window. Like, it's really important to tap in, especially as an athlete, for that. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. Like, people hear that, and even in the college space, and I've heard presentations from physiologists of like nutrition recommendations and training recommendations that are like so black and white when it's such a multifaceted picture, where it's like, I'll have student athletes come to me and be like, I should eat more carbs during this phase. Or like, I should eat more of this during this. And I'm like, yes, and, or that depends. Like, I think, can you speak on like the flexibility on that, of like knowing, like, even in a college or even a pro cycle, when you don't have the privilege, I guess is the best word for it, to really specify training, like to come in one day and be like, if it was like a heavy lift, run day and it fell on the time of cycle where you feel like shit, like, what can you speak on, like, you can still do the training?
It's a good question. I think part of it too is like, and we talked about this before too, it's about like low-hanging fruit. So in terms of like nutrition, and again, like, I am not a dietitian, so I'm not out there counseling people, and I shouldn't be. That's out of scope of practice. But it's like, you like, okay, you should be eating more carbs. Well, how many carbs are you eating in the first place? Right? Like, you had talked about, you're like, you know, you've got an athlete that comes in that's like, I want to do this crazy supplement. And you're like, okay, well, like, let's do a diet log and like, let's see where you're at. Like, what kind of supplement would be the best? And they're eating 500 calories a day. And you're like, okay. Like, before we go to supplements, like, maybe let's think about like lunch, you know? And so I think that there's a lot of low hanging fruit. I also think that when you're a college athlete, like, there is very little that you do control. And to your point of self-awareness, so much of being a high-level athlete is actually like detaching your brain from your body, right? Like, you have to separate it because right now sucks and this physically hurts and this is exhausting and I don't want to do it, but I have to do it. And so I've got to separate it. And self-awareness is really also like with this, you know, attunement to biofeedback, it's bringing those two things back into harmony. Because once you graduate, and you and I have talked about this many times before, you're like, oh, so how do I know what to do today in the gym? Because I don't have a strength coach writing me a program anymore. Mm-hmm. And like, what is the purpose that training is serving in my life? Because when you're an athlete, you need to develop these physiological adaptations to have these physical capacities. That's part of what strength and conditioning is for. And if you don't have a strength coach that is willing to be flexible or dynamic, like, then you, that's like the pro, like you got to do what your coach is writing for you. I think the flexibility, I think for nutrition, it can be on the individual, but I think in strength and conditioning in collegiate sport, it's on the coach. And I sold myself as like a dynamic strength coach, which just mean like I'll go on vibes. Like I go out to the soccer field and I'd be like, these vibes don't feel like we should run grids today. They feel like maybe we should do like some strides and then like some crawling on the ground and then maybe a walk through campus. That feels like our vibes today. And the athletic trainer would be like, yeah, that's the vibes today. And so like, if like as a strength coach, I think it's so important to be flexible and dynamic to be able to meet the needs of your athletes. And I'm not saying that every strength coach needs to train programming by the menstrual cycle. I don't think it's necessary for every athlete. I don't think that it is applicable for every environment. But I think like when you're at like the higher and higher levels of elite sport, we're thinking about like 1% is the difference between a gold medal and a bronze medal, right? Mm-hmm. And so if tweaking it, and even if it's like a lot of strength coaches are doing it just on like wellness scores. So like, you know, like a fatigue, mood, soreness, stress, sleep quality, readiness aggregate is really common. And being able to tweak like the amount of load that you're putting on the athlete. I think being a dynamic coach and being able to have that feel and have that coach's eye of like, what does my athlete need today? That's something that is really hard to teach, but is really important to be able to be flexible. So I think that flexibility and being dynamic is really critical for practitioners and for athletes. But I think that there's also like some low level, like low hanging fruit. Like you can go in and you can do any type of training session on any day. But like also, I think it's important to like validate those days when you're like, no, I do feel like garbage and my legs do feel like cement. And I do look in the mirror and feel like I gained 20 pounds and my strength coach is going to light me on fire for that. And I don't know why I did everything right. Like I went to bed early and I drank my Pedialyte and I had my protein. Like I did everything I was supposed to do. And yet I feel like I got hit by a bus today. And it's interesting, I was reading a qualitative article about collegiate athletes coming back from injury and their experiences in like the gender differences of men and women in elite collegiate sport returning from injury. And they were asked this question of, do you think your gender impacts your rehab process, your return to play process? And both athletes said no, both, you know, groups, both genders. And a common response from women was like, I'm just as motivated as my male counterparts. And so, you know, like, you know, I have the same drive as them. But then when we looked at like the men and the women and their experience with their practitioners, so their athletic trainers, their strength coaches, their dietitians, their sport coaches, women felt invalidated and they didn't feel like they had trust and empathy in that process. And I think that like some of that is like some of the quotes that were used is like some women felt like they were pushed too much. Like they would get there and they'd be like, I feel like I got hit by a bus and you want me to do all this. Like I've had multiple surgeries. Like this isn't what I need today. And some female athletes felt under pushed. They're like, this is too easy. Like you're not working hard enough to know what I need to do. I'm going to go do my rehab on my own 2 or 3 more times. And so I am biased, but I think some of that lack of bringing those two things into harmony of like the athlete experience and what they need and what practitioners are prescribing them is a lack of female physiology. Because if we are considering the menstrual cycle in that process, then we are thinking about like, there are days when you're going to come in at default and you're going to feel like garbage. And so adding more on, like from a physiological standpoint, like you might not have the capacity to gain muscle. You might not have the capacity to be anabolic right now. You have high progesterone. Progesterone relates to higher catabolism. So you have muscles breaking down at default. So adding like a big hypertrophy set is not going to be advantageous. You're actually not going to get the adaptations from those. So I think it's really complex. But I think even just starting that conversation of considering it and being flexible and dynamic is something that we have to. And also in collegiate sport, it's seasons where they have multiple competitions like per week sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to be dynamic in how we're dosing out that training load and matching that kind of fitness and fatigue model of like, we need to hit high spikes of training load as like Don Scott says it, like as a vaccine against injury. So we've got to have that like high intensity dose, but we need to understand when we're doing that in relation to the individual where they're at, and also in relation to like where the distribution of training load is going to be in that week. So I don't think it's simple. I think it's really complex. I think that like asking the questions and also implementing like some scientific processes of like, say you have an athlete that does want to try a supplement and you've got them to like a good base nutritional intake. Okay, well, let's have some like, you know, let's have some tests. Let's have like a battery of like, how do you feel? How are you performing? Then let's try it for a few weeks and then let's rerun those tests. And like that process of auditing, I think a lot of strength coaches in particular is what I can speak to, because those are the people that I know. Like, we are afraid that like, what if we do these testing and then we show that our program isn't working, right? And like, I've attached my value as an individual to my ability as a strength coach. And so if I write a program that isn't working, well, now I don't have any like internal self-worth, when in reality, you should want to know if your program isn't working. And you should have really consistent testing batteries to audit the efficacy of the different elements that you're programming. And so, yeah, I don't think I have a good answer for you on that one. But I think that being flexible and being dynamic is so important for every person in the process.
Yeah, I think that answered the question beautifully, honestly, because there is no black and white answer on every day. Like, we know that certain levels of hormones are high and low versus like whatever on whatever day that you are in, but that could also fluctuate. So it's like,
yeah,
there is no specific nutrient that you need. I mean, there's like nutrients to kind of help with inflammation and like general diet plans and all of those things. But like, I hear these things of just like, so black and white, or even combating, like, I just think there should be a balance of the subjective nature of, which is kind of like a new age model of training. Yeah, so totally. It kind of like bumps edges with the old school of like, just push through it. And it's like, well, actually our cortisol is high, male or female, our cortisol is high. Our HRV was really shit last night. And actually maxing out today might injure us. So let's look at like the actual research and subjective feelings and all of those things. I think, again, it kind of goes back to the self-awareness of the athlete and being realistic with those things. And if you want to be the best of the best, having that awareness, but also being honest with yourself of just like, do I actually feel like shit or not?
Yeah, like totally. Because I think that like, I think that a lot of like, you know, kind of that old school, like, oh, let me just leave in the body. You're like, no, you know, like that. I think, we should avoid pain. Sometimes I think is a good thing. I think that like that the thought is like that everything rides and dies on that subjectivity, that like if an athlete like they're just going to report that they're fatigued, so they're not going to have a hard lift. Like, okay, well then I think that might speak to your weight room culture, and that is something that we might want to, you know, work on, that they don't feel like they can be honest with you, that they don't want to come in and work hard. But I also think that like self-awareness is such an important and a critical quality to possess to be an empowered woman. And, you know, like ultimately, like I've had the privilege, like, I, you know, I've been able to work with like all different teams at UNC. And really, like for me as a researcher now, it's about like the practitioners, but like my passion is really just to like sport, I think, is just an avenue. Like, it's a way to teach girls and women about themselves and to teach them these important qualities so that they can go in and they can be empowered and they can be whatever they want to be, because that's what it was for me. Like, it's the one place where I got to be loud and demanding and big and strong and a leader and direct, and like those qualities were rewarded in the place of sport, and they're not rewarded anywhere else in what? The world, right?
What?
And so like, because I grew up constantly playing sports, I was like, mm-hmm. I was protected from so much misogyny, to the point where by the time I got to the real world, I was like, I don't actually care if you think that I'm too loud or I'm too much or I'm too direct. This is who I am, and I'm gonna go accomplish whatever I want to accomplish. I'm gonna go to one of the top research institutions in the country at 27 years old and leave my career I've been investing for years into, to an area where I have no experience, and totally start over.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it, and I'm going to be great, and I'm going to survive. I'm going to be fine. You know, like, but it's like, it is this empowerment, and you have to have self-awareness for that. And so I think because female athletes don't have as many professional playing opportunities, and even the ones that do, when they leave those, they have to go and get another job. Like, we can't go play pro and then just ride off into the sunset on all our pro earnings. We don't have
millions
that much.
Of dollars. Like,
right. It, you know, like, it's
that people have to work full-time jobs while they're professional athletes.
Oh, exactly. Or they have to play in multiple professional leagues to be able to supplement their income. And so realistically, and it's like, you know, we say all the time, but like, girls who play sports become women who lead. We have the data to support it. We've got to teach them this self-awareness now. Mm-hmm. And we've got to teach them this ability of, like, you know, like you're talking about, like, you know, that we just tell them what to do in the warm-up and that's so small. But like, I use a lot of like auto-regulation in my programming. And so there was one time where, like, you know, the RPEs were like so wide, and I was like, well, this is not what I'm trying to accomplish here. I want them to be able to come in and do what they need to do, because strength and conditioning is that 90% of the iceberg under the water. And on top of the water is their sport. That's what matters. And so I just need to get them here as the most robust, resilient, ready, prepared athlete I can. And so some days that means a 20-minute bike ride. And some days that means, you know, setting a new training max, right? Like, it's different. But I'm obviously, in that moment, I was like, I'm not in tune with what it is they need if I'm getting such a widespread in these RPEs per session. And so they came in the next session, and it was like their sheets were blank. And I was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. It's kind of like a training menu, right? Like, I want you to do a lower body movement. Here are some good options. If you're going to, you know, if you want to do like a low intensity, here's the volume, here's the intensity. If you want to do like kind of a moderate, you know, and so I gave them all the structures, the pieces of it. They had to choose themselves. And I had one athlete that was like, Sam, just tell me what to do. And I was like, this is the hard part. The hard part is figuring out, how do you feel? Why do you feel that way? And then what it is that you need to do today to get upstairs to the volleyball court to be the best version of you. And that's a skill that we need for the rest of our lives. And so if we can teach it to them when it's controlled, and when, you know, they like, there's low stakes on it, because you've got a strength coach there to be like, okay, but also then this, I see where you're going with this, but this is what we're going to do. Then when they get into the real world, they can do it for themselves. And I think that those skills translate to more than sport, because we unfortunately don't get to play sport for the rest of our lives. And so it is a little bit about that big picture.
Yeah, the self-efficacy there, and like the shift of really tapping in. I mean, everything we've talked about, like even with the menstrual cycle and everything, like if you don't know how you're feeling, you can't put the action items out there. And
yes.
There's a huge disconnect there, especially like male or female, but for sure on the female side, with this like deeper level of the hormone fluctuation and the cycle and all of those things. Men have that too, by the way.
Yeah.
But on a much shorter scale. I think just tapping into the empowerment and being a female in sport and all of those things, like in your research, is so, I mean, I want to say new, like not your research, but the topic that you're researching and the implementation of that is relatively like just new. We talked about the new school versus the old school, all of those things. How would you say, how do you continue to have that confidence and to have the, like, I don't care if you think I am too much. I don't care if you actually believe that you should check in with your athletes or not. Like, you should, like, this is my belief. Like, how do you continue when no one around you, like the perception is no one around you, like, knows what you're doing, believes in what you're doing, has seen what you're doing, like implementing this new way of thinking and training and all of those things? How do you keep, what keeps you going? And it could be simple, could be complex.
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's a few different areas. I think the first one is I don't necessarily have the skills to be able to do it any other way in terms of like, if I think that something's right, like I don't have, it's kind of like I also sometimes don't have the skill of like not speaking my mind, you know, like if for better or for worse, like I just had to do this like self-evaluation with my advisor. And like, one of them was like, you know, speaking up for yourself when you have like an opposing opinion. And I was like, strongly agree, arguably my best skill.
Charts.
Yeah. And like, and she, you know, she's like, you know, I do think that is a strong suit of yours. And I don't have the skill of not speaking up. I don't have like the, mm-hmm. I just don't know how to do that. And like, it absolutely, sometimes I'm like, man, like I have learned how to sometimes like curb it in terms of like delivering it in a different way or like figuring out like how to play the game. But I've never been good at that. And so for me, like, it's not even about science. It's very much like less about like strength and conditioning outcomes. It's like this lens of equity where like, when we're looking at like the fitness fatigue model or like, you know, high low model or all these different periodization models, we have those because of this foundational research, mm-hmm. which was done on men. And so in my view, it is this equitable lens of like, we as strength coaches, we develop these programs and we audit them and we do all this work, but are we calling into question the information and where it comes from and how we learned it? Because that information wasn't done on women. So who's to say that it applies? And like, people are always like, they talk about how, you know, like we shouldn't be black and white. And there's some people that believe that we shouldn't change training across the menstrual cycle, that, you know, like it's not more beneficial, but in reality, it's like, compared to what? Compared to this like baseline periodization model that was based on men, like that's with the understanding that this baseline model has been researched on women and that it has been shown to be more efficacious, like, which is also not true, you know? So like, I think for me, like it really is like, it's just constantly questioning where things are from. Like, you know, that little kid that's like, why? Like, I think that that's a little bit of me as an adult. And I think part of that also comes from like my second internship at University of Portland with Kat and Brad. We would like, you were supposed to ask questions. Like Kat, who's, I mean, she's more than a mentor, she's like a personal hero. She would like finish a session and she'd be like, okay, what notes do you have for me? And I was like, I'm 21 years old. I'm just happy to be here. Like, what are you talking about?
The vibes are great. So
yeah, no notes. I was like, this was really good. And she was like, okay, that doesn't actually help me. Like, right. And I was like, oh my God. And she was like, if you don't have one point of feedback of mm-hmm. something that I could do better after every session, then you're not paying attention. And so for me, like kind of growing up as a strength coach in that environment, like that's where I was like, you're supposed to ask questions, if nothing else, for me to learn why you've done it the way that you have, because maybe I should be doing it that way. So it's this like constant environment of like questioning and learning. And like, that's not just like what's rewarded, that's what's required. Right. And so like, I don't quite always know, I don't work well in environments, not well received in environments where like that is not the norm. Yeah. And so I think that that's really important, is like, it is this lens of like, I think that girls and women deserve more. I think that we deserve more at every stage in our life. And sometimes I put a little bit too much pressure on myself. I'm like, God, if I take a week off, then like feminism is probably going to crack. And with my absence, my husband's like, okay, like, we might be overstating the importance a little bit, you know, like, there's an extra week and you're going to be okay. But like, for me, it is like, it feels existential. It yeah. feels bigger than strength and conditioning. It feels bigger than sport. It feels like we are giving girls and women the keys to write their own stories. And that could be in sport and it could be out of sport, but like, we're teaching them these skills to empower them so that they can go and surpass any limitation that's put on them. And so it feels very big picture to me. And I think the your question too about like, how do you sustain it? It definitely like wears on me. Like, misogyny mm-hmm. is like hard and it's yeah. so ingrained in some of these systems. And so I think something that really helps is like finding your co-conspirators, because it does feel like a conspiracy sometimes doing this work. And so like finding those people that like when I was looking for a PhD advisor, I remember I was talking to my friend Marcy Daniel at University of Washington, and I was like, I think I want a woman. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I think I do, because I don't want to have to explain why it matters anymore. I'm so exhausted of getting people to listen to me. Like, I felt like my first 5 years in my career was just getting people to listen to me. And that's exhausting, because it does, you are like, there are moments when you're like, well, maybe I'm just making a big hoopla out of nothing. Like, maybe it's not worth it.
Yeah. You know, 100% can relate to that on the nutrition side.
Yeah. Because you're like, how much do I fight uphill versus like, maybe all of this resistance is because my ideas are bad.
Right. And I,
you know,
and just to speak on the environments, I mean, sports is changing. It's evolving, but it is still very much male dominated. And being a strong, assertive, for the lack of better words, like woman that can speak her mind and can go into any boardroom and be like, why are we doing this? Why is this a thing? A lot of people can perceive that and be defensive about that.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I don't know what the right word is, why they're doing it. I'm not a psychologist, but
not yet.
But it is extremely frustrating to have to funnel or play the game, air quotes on that, like navigating how to tailor your approach to things. Because I've been told in multiple job like situations of like, you can't be the bull in the china shop all the time.
Oh my god, the number of times I've heard it,
you know what I mean? Like, but it's like, also like, is anything going to get done if I'm not? And I think speaking on the defensive lens and like the why questioning and all of those things, can you speak a little bit on collaborating with multiple people in an interdisciplinary team, and how do you navigate that with like, why are we doing this? And people are like, whoa, we've been doing this for forever. And you're just going to come in here and question me. And then it becomes a point of tension. How, I guess, just on the collaboration piece, like.
Yeah. A little bit. Yeah. Well, I think sometimes I'm like, well, I wouldn't have to be a bull in the china shop if you guys would just get on board. If you guys would just listen. Which I don't think is like the best way to go about that either. But right. I'm like, just responding to you, you know, like I'm just giving you what you're giving me. Which I don't recommend either. I think like in terms of collaborating, like there's a couple different ways to do it. Like I feel so lucky. I think one of the best things that happened in COVID is that like social media really created these avenues to develop collaborations, because we had nothing else to do. And so I was able to find some people who were really invested in the work that I was doing, and they were doing similar, you know, avenues of it at their own place. And so like to find people like, you know, at University of Washington, like I've done so much work with Marsa and with their Center for Leadership in Athletics, and because they're incredible people and we have similar values. And I think once you find those shared values, I'm like, Marcia, you tell me what the project is and I'm in, I'll do it. I'll do whatever you tell me to, you know? And I think like similar with Abby at UNC, like because there are so many voices and opinions on every side of it. And like the menstrual cycle research space is a very hotly debated and controversial one. Like we're not all on the same page. And so I'm like, there are just baseline things that I don't have the spirit to defend anymore. And I think too, like, if we look at like, there's that matrix, and it's like people who are willing and people who are able, right? And so like the red box of like people who are not willing and not able, those aren't my people. And the orange box of people who maybe are able but not willing, those also aren't my people. And I think that I'm very privileged to be at a point in my career where it's like, if you bring me in, this is why you're bringing me in. Like mm-hmm. you're resistant to this, but this is why you brought me here. So you need to maybe go do some like internal reflection on like why you brought me here. If this is not what we're, if we are not here to be innovative for the the development and the progress of female athletes, then why am I here? Because that's like what I do. So let's talk about it, you know?
And I think just like to interject there, like knowing your spaces in this field, like asking that question in interviews, if people are like interested in this or have similar, can resonate, like, are you willing to hire me knowing this is what I'm doing? Do you want that? And being okay, like, if they're like, no, I just need a strength coach. I just need a sports scientist. I just need to run the GPS. Like, cool. I am going to walk away from this because it's not aligned with what I want to do.
Totally. Because also that strategy that I pulled with Nate, I have pulled in other interviews and it has not worked out. Like, I have gotten calls and they said, Sam Moore, we want you for this job. And I said, I don't think I want this job, but what if I sell you the job I want? Right. And they're like, okay, deal. Like, we want you to interview. We want you, we want to hire you. And I'm like, okay, great. And I go in and I give my spiel and empowerment, and we're going to do it. And we're going to value women and we're going to give them resources and we're going to level the playing field. And they're like, we actually are not ready for that. And I'm like, fair enough. You know, like, and it is something I think that I've been so privileged at. And I also have to, unfortunately, enter the job force again after I finish my PhD, which I'm so nervous about. So like, I'm kind of like at the beginning, like I have to start applying for jobs in the next few months. And like, that is something where it's like, I don't know when it happened. It feels like it happened overnight. I feel like I just started coaching like 2 weeks ago. But I think I've been so lucky where I've been able to keep my interest broad of like, really like empowering girls and women and sport science, which are both very general. And I've been able to find this very unique avenue and place for myself in this world where like, now that's what I do. And I have the experience and I have the, you know, the things on my resume to be able to say, this is how I've done it. And this is what I do. And this is what I want to do. And would you like to hire me to do that? And, you know, hopefully somebody says yes in the next year. But like, to that point, it's about finding people that have those same shared values and priorities. And like, we can debate what the best way forward is that. And I want that. Like, I want my ideas to be evaluated. I want them to be audited. I don't just want people around me to just like say yes, and then we do it. Like, I'm not saying I know the best way forward, but I'm saying we need to be all have this shared goal. And if we've got this shared goal, then like, let's figure out who's got the best idea and let's put it together to get it there. But I think when we're talking about like collaboration, particularly with like interdisciplinary collaboration, you know, I think that sports science and nutrition are probably on like a similar footing in that they're newer in the application of it compared to strength and conditioning. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times when you're trying to get in the door, you have to demonstrate value before you can establish the need for your position. And so I can understand, you know, like some of the territorialness around that. But I think like in terms of sports science, like the more you do, the more value you've added, the more need that you've established. And the only way that you're going to be able to really be innovative at this point is to be collaborative. And I think that like there's so many different models of collaboration. You know, like there's the interdisciplinary versus multidisciplinary. And so to move along, you know, move forward during that like collaboration, the disciplinary continuum, it requires like knowledge sharing. Like I have to know about elements of nutrition to then go back to my lab and say, okay, well, if this is what they're looking at, right, and this is what strength and conditioning is looking at, here's how we can do that body composition testing. And here's how we can give these variables to this practitioner to help them make decisions and these variables to this practitioner. And also, what are we delivering to the athlete? Like it requires everyone to have to share about their own field so that we can create these very integrated innovations that are so much more effective in their impact.
Yeah. And then focusing on the data and not necessarily ego, like coming at it from a shared approach when that data is collaborative, I think creating that space for everyone to be less territorial, to be more willing to share, to not gatekeep like data, because it's like, wait, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
It's like creating that safe space of like, no, I'm going to magnify it and add my stuff. And then we're all going to talk about it. Like,
exactly.
The betterment for the group. So yeah, I think just pivoting drastically to, like, you kind of mentioned the gray area between sports science and nutrition and supplements and all of those things. I do want to speak, because your research is a little bit on the creatine side of things, and speaking on the benefits of, like, that luteal phase when water is kind of outside of the cell, and or types of phases in the cycle where creatine could help modulate that, and why, and the misconceptions around that.
Yeah, it's so, you know, we talked about this before, but, like, when I got to UNC, I was not a nutrition whiz by any means, but, like, that was the lab that I walked into, was a lot of nutrition, a lot of body composition, among a lot of other things. And the first project was a master's thesis on creatine supplementation across the menstrual cycle. And we had had, we have a small tight-knit lab group, and the protocol was quite intense. So it had, like, a baseline visit, and then it had a pre and post supplementation, and it was a loading dose of creatine in each menstrual phase. And it was a double blind placebo controlled study. And I think we had, like, over 50 participants for 5 visits each. And it was me and a master's student. And that's, and, like, I got thrown into it, and credit to her, Amanda Gordon, she's at the Washington Spirit now. I mean, she stepped up and she ran that study. She was supposed to run it, like, with another master's student, and it ended up just being her. And I mean, she killed it. That, like, study won awards. It was crazy, but it was, like, I had to learn about creatine really quick. And it was incredible, because when we think about creatine and, like, how it's discussed in, you know, like, popular culture, like, it's a super mass lean gainer and it's for performance and, like, bodybuilders. And so we don't associate, you know, creatine with, like, our menstrual cycles or with women at all or with menopause, you know. Mm-hmm. And the benefits of creatine, it's one of the most researched dietary supplements with, and it has one of the fewest, like, adverse reactions. Mm-hmm. The one of the biggest myths about it is cramps, muscle cramps, and dehydration. Mm-hmm. And that was, like, from some studies in the 80s with football players. And football players in the 80s, some assumptions there about some of their supplementation protocols. Okay. You know, just, I wasn't there. I don't know what happened.
Picture. Just one big picture.
I'm wondering what our, like, inclusion criteria was for that study. You know, like, I don't know. Okay. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But what I do know is that if we look at, like, the molecular structure of creatine, it actually goes against the likelihood of cramping and dehydration, because it pulls water into the cell. So it would improve hydration parameters. And so for this study, we had so many different outcomes that we looked at, and Amanda's published her thesis, and she was looking at more of the recovery and performance outcomes across the menstrual cycle. But one of the biggest reasons that women don't take creatine is because they don't want to gain water weight. And that's totally fair. I think on the other side, we don't publicize the benefits of creatine that would specifically help women, mm-hmm. Hydration among them, brain fog, mood, energy levels, cell regeneration. Like, you know, Dr. Smith Ryan talks about how it's, like, one of the best supplements that you're, like, pre and postnatal, that your doctor will never tell you to take. If you look at, like, how much energy it takes to create a human and then, like, feed a human and repair your own body,
right?
Like, that's yeah. what creatine can help with, you know? And so we don't really talk about it, but so many women are afraid to take it because of the water weight gain. And so what we looked at with my first author publication was we looked at fluid distribution. So looking at total body water and then intra and extracellular fluid with the placebo and then with active supplement of creatine in a loading dose in the different phases of the menstrual cycle. And so, you know, basically, and I think I mentioned it earlier, but that increased progesterone and estrogen, they increase the permeability of the cell. And so you have a shift towards the extracellular space, so less intracellular fluid. And really, creatine is kind of offsetting what's happening with your hormones in that luteal phase. So what we saw was significantly increased intracellular and extracellular fluid with creatine supplementation in that luteal phase, but no significant changes of body mass. So what does that mean? That means like the mean of all of our subjects, that's what we found. You might be a non-responder to creatine, you might be a super responder to creatine, but you know, the average middle is that the small amount of gain in body mass was not significantly different from the pre-supplementation time point or from the amount of gain that was seen in the follicular phase. So it kind of combats that myth. And I don't think it's totally a myth, because that water weight gain is something that we do consistently see in male subjects, in male studies. But again, the physiology is different. And oftentimes with the creatine literature that I looked into to write that publication, either males and females were analyzed together. So they were analyzed separately. It wasn't controlled for menstrual phase, or it wasn't evaluated exclusively in that luteal phase. It was only evaluated in the follicular phase. And so I think, again, like when we're talking about equity, creatine is such an important supplement that would benefit so many people. But this finding from male populations is extrapolated to female populations. And we're told like, well, why would it, you know, hypothetically, like, why would it be any different? Or it's just too difficult to study the menstrual cycle. You know, there's like a range of different reasons why we're told that it wouldn't work, that it's too difficult to evaluate. But being able to be a part of that project and to evaluate, look at those data, and to write that paper was such a huge privilege and a huge honor, because it was such an example of like, well, now we have the data to say that this isn't happening in women, because we did a female-centric experimental design. Mm-hmm. To evaluate this thing. And now we can, you know, translate that to more women, and more women can be taking a supplement that can help with so many different aspects of their life.
Yeah, no, it's truly life-changing, honestly, for like, it's groundbreaking with the research, just because for context, we kind of hinted at it, but most research studies are geared towards men.
Yeah.
So the shift in that, number one, is imperative for just female sports, females in general throughout a lifespan, and all of those things. And I think there's so many miseducations, misconceptions around even just all of what we're talking about, but especially the creatine side of things, like that it is actually a metabolic energy system. Like,
yeah.
Like it is actually used for a main source of that, like in athletics. Yeah. And people don't even understand that side of things.
Right.
But, and then the fluid balance as well, like throughout the cycle, is again imperative for female athletes. So.
Yeah. I think something too, like when I first started at UNC and really like through my undergrad, like I was kind of taught that supplements were just for like if you have a deficiency. And that was kind of like the lens I took on them. But then, like to that point, I never got my blood done in college. I don't get them done now frequently, and like, you know, once every few years with my insurance will pay for it. And so like in terms of like deficiencies, like I don't know if I have any deficiencies. And I think, you know, I do a decent job. I eat a decent diet when I can remember to eat, you know, like it's a full-time job to eat enough protein anyway, but like it's doing the best I can. And so I think that my mindset switched. We wrote a really cool paper. Dr. Smith Rant got an opportunity to write this paper for the GSSI, the Gatorade Sports Science Institute Exchange, I think that's what that stands for. And it was looking at dietary supplements for active women. And so we made this really cool figure that was, you know, kind of like a list of different supplements, common supplements, what the supplement is, what it purports to do, like what the effect is, and then what the strength and the amount of research that we have on that supplement in women. And that was really enlightening to be able to see like a lot of the supplements that we're talking about that are like marketed to women don't have any, if at all, quality research or any volume of research in women. But it also, like when I look at, you know, like when I conceptualize like my menstrual cycle and like my symptoms, you don't have to suffer through those symptoms. Like I don't have to suffer through bad sleep in my luteal phase. Now there's things that I do, right? Like I take my creatine and I take my different supplements and I do some hydration things differently. And I change the environment of the room that I sleep in during that phase specifically because I know that that's the symptom that hits me the hardest. And so what can I do? Like, what kind of supplements can I take during that phase? And really, it's like, if you're struggling in like that premenstrual window, then it's like the week before that is when you should kind of like take those supplements to help prepare for that window. But I think for me, it's been a total source, like the education has been a source of empowerment. And that's what we see across every discipline. But like, I don't have to be a walking zombie for 4 days in my luteal phase. And I don't have to cry at every sad song on the radio on my drive into school. You know, like, you don't have to suffer through it. There are things you can do. And so I think doing that paper specifically, but really just being around Dr. Smith-Ryan and learning from her, just so much knowledge on it, that like, you don't have to wait until you're deficient in something to get a supplement. Like, there are some applications of different supplements or like nutrition changes or like different things that you could do so that you can improve the quality of life now, you know, and that has changed my mindset towards a lot of nutrition related things.
Yeah. And I think it's like a echoing message throughout this entire conversation, but the self-awareness.
Yeah, it really
comes back to the self-awareness of what your symptoms are, what you're feeling, what you're experiencing in regards to like the menstrual cycle. What day of my cycle does this start? And then also, you touched on it, but like, it's not just adding the supplements. It's looking at it from a holistic view of like the low hanging fruit. What is my room environment like? Like, cherry juice can help me sleep, or what, creatine can help me sleep and have energy levels. But like, what am I doing other than that? So
yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, like you can take all the supplements in the world, but like, if you're hammering like 3 margaritas before you go to bed, like you're going to sleep so bad. Or like, if you're staying up till like 3 a.m. and you have to wake up at 7, like you're going to be fatigued. That's not your menstrual cycle. That's your bedtime. You know, like there are, and like, even when I was like, when I got into it, I went from a really active job to a really sedentary job of like, you know, like I would have visits all day, but then I'd be sitting in class all day. And then I'd be sitting at my computer and writing all day and doing, you know, data analysis. And so like, I struggled at the beginning of it. I was like, oh my God, I've got low back pain, unreal low back pain. Like, what am I, 50 years old and crazy? And so like, one of the things that I did is like, I did all my body comp scans. I did a DEXA scan. I do a DEXA scan like every few months now, like, you know, 3 to 6 months, depends. I do some like hydrate, I do our little in-body, right? Like, I've got all this technology around me and I've been taught how to use it. I did like a diet log. I did a 3-day diet log and I did my RMR. And so I looked at my RMR results and I'm like, okay, I'm burning 2000 calories like at default, but my RQ says that like, I'm so low. Like, I'm like burning protein. Like, what's happening? I'm like, I'm under fueled. And so I did a 3-day diet log and I was significantly under eating. I was under eating everything. Like, I cannot exist on 1750 calories a day. Right. That's not my truth. And so like, I don't do a diet log every single day, but like, if I'm having a hard time, if I don't feel good, if I'm getting sick often, then I'll reevaluate, right? Like, I'll run my scans, do my tests, look at my diet for 3 days and I'll say, okay, like I can clearly see that like, I'm like, for me, it's carbs and protein. Like, it is so hard. So I have to figure out like when I go and buy a protein supplement, I'm sitting on the ground in Harris Teeter and I'm like spinning all of them around to find like, what's the one that has carbs? Like we're such a carb phobic society. That's like 90% of these protein powders have 1 gram of carbs. And I'm like, that doesn't even get me close to my 2-to-1 ratio. Like, this is exhausting. And so I like have to find that, or like, I'm like, should I be doing a carb supplement? Or like, you know, so like, I just feel like the low hanging fruit is also part of that, but it is that self-awareness of like, I don't feel my best. Let me, before I make a million changes, let me kind of track things for a little while, see where I'm at, and then see what things I can realistically improve. Because realistically, I have to be at a computer for 8 to 10 hours a day sometimes. Mm-hmm. What can I do in that process? Can I have a walking meeting instead of a Zoom meeting? Can I, you know, stand up and do 10 bodyweight squats every 45 minutes and set a little reminder to do that? Like, what can I do with what's in front of me to get myself to that level? And then what kind of extra things do I need on top of that? And I think that's really been an empowering experience of learning so much more about like the application of more things than just my training program.
Right. And I think that's so important for athletes to hear, like, kind of as we close the conversation and like really kind of summarize everything that we've talked about, to be honest, it really kind of goes back to like knowing what you're doing and like diving into it, asking questions and being empowered and surrounding yourself with people that validate those things. Like, hey, I did shit on these days. This is what happened. This is what I did leading up to it. How can I be better? How can I do this differently and tweak it a little bit? So
that's
all of it's crucial.
Yeah. But yeah.
Sam, I appreciate your time. And I feel like we could talk about this for hours on end on the women empowerment, the self-awareness, the menstrual cycle, the supplements, all of it. But is there anywhere people can connect with you, like social media? I'll link your publications and all of those things in the show notes for people. But where can people connect with you?
Yeah, my website, I think I should probably update my publications on there. It's moresportscience.com, M-O-O-R-E, just my last name. And then my social media, Instagram and Twitter are both Sam Moore Strong.
Awesome.
So yeah, shoot me an email. Can't promise how quick I will get back to you, but I will do my best, okay? Jesse has learned firsthand that once I'm here, I'm here.
We just gotta get in the room.
I gotta get in the room. I'm an in-person gal, you know. I lack a little bit of luster texting, and sometimes I'm not good on my email, but like once I'm in person, baby, I'm all in. Yeah. So thank you for your grace and your patience. And this was so fun. Thank you so much. This has been great. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone listening, thank you for listening. I hope this changed your perspective and open up perspective on things that you might not know about and resonate with, or maybe empowered you. Sam, thank you again. And everyone else, we will see you on the next episode.